Okay, cool. I'm very impressed that, so many people are willing and able to think about things at this early in the morning, because most of the time I'd be like, back to bed. Autonomy is going back to sleep. Okay, cool.
Okay. So what I want to do here is not present a completely, you know, worked out statement, but just a few thoughts I want to just disperse in debate. And this is coming out of my training is as a sociologist, and I was doing work on global citizenship, and I realized, was realizing that sociology in particular is so tied with particular assumptions about how politics work, that there are all these different forms of political actor and corporation and community that in mainstream sociology models just don't exist because they can't fit. So it's like, well, they're not real. So just thinking about, like, well, why is that? And so what I'm going to do is talk about, question here is, what is the changing role of the state in state power relation to flows of global capital? And I think you both said in various forms, I think this is really important because the nature of sovereignty itself is transforming itself and committing itself in relation to global capital. And there was a period about the mid-90s, when a lot of social theory seemed to have this impression that globalization was going to just, like, do away with the state, it was going to, like, wither away, and that global capital would somehow magically smash the state power for us. That was kind of silly. But it was kind of fun to read, because for a second it actually sounded like a bunch of social scientists were actually anarchists, but that wasn't really true. It's also interesting because from 92 to 94 is actually when Empire was written. So when you're trying to, like, think about, or get to put it in that context of, like, what was happening at that point. And I think what has been happening is not a decline of sovereignty, but how sovereignty is being re-territorialized and transformed. And reordering, how state power operates, and which is, this is kind of pressing, because state power, as you indicated, is not necessarily just operating through the strictly formal means, but is also in the form of private security companies, drug tests, random frisks, all these different diffuse means, which even if they aren't recognized as official parts of state power, in fact are. And so, again, if we want to, subvert, smash, or even just squish the state, we have to know, what is it? So, I'm going to make perhaps some of a bizarre statement that I think could guide how to look at this. The state does not exist. And I feel a little bit silly saying this because I've been in court for a week, and it's pretty obvious that, the government is making my body have to do certain things, or else bad shit's gonna happen. But what I want to say is not that government power and systems control don't exist, because they clearly do, and are permeating many more aspects of our lives constantly. But I think the error is talking about the state as if it's a single, coherent, unified, totalizing process, which it's not. And if we talk about the state as one single subject, this tends to reify, mystify, and fetishize the working of state power itself, and to imbue it with a form of unity that it doesn't actually have. So I want to talk about the state neither as an autonomous realm object of subject where politics happens, which is sort of how Weber talks about the state, nor as sort of like the executive committee that reflects class relations, which is the general Marxist take on it, nor as a strictly object of ideology, which is sort of, I guess, that's coming out of like Althusser. But one way we're talking about the state here, it is both the material processes, regulations, forms of coordination, control that work in the physical world, as well as the ideological, philosophical, and political concepts which construct and attempt to, make these things a unified, coherent whole and call this, the state. And it's these two things working together, both, the process of domination and the ideas which then connect them. And then, then you're talking about the idea of the state, the construction of the state out of these disparate and contradictory practices. And in some ways, the idea of the state is just as much a part of domination as the processes of control in themselves. This is interesting to think about, because we talk about, historical evolution of government. It's not like, you know, one day someone sat down and said, I want to invent the state. No, that never happened. But it was more a process of, you know, feudal lords and barons trying to extract, you know, land and loyalty and capital out of people generally to conduct wars. And then these processes sort of ossified into you know bureaucracy and ways to get these done more efficiently, And then it's funny because as that occurred, you know, instead of having this like, you know, these sort of like the sort of open relation between, you know, here's the ruler and just as the subject, then was the invention of the people. So all of a sudden, people were then used to justify, you know, and create this gloss over how power was working. And the problem is that if we discuss the state as a unified, you know, subject and object, we're sort of prevented from seeing the contradictions, holes, and openings in how power is working. Because if it's just one thing, there's just this one giant block which is sort of like, you know, ruling and dominating everything, it's much harder to see places where it's falling apart or contradicting itself working against itself. And so I think this is kind of, you know, a big mistake to make because if we want to talk about, you know, finding ways, you know, to build autonomy, to create realms of freedom, we need to be able to appreciate places where like it exists that we don't see. And so the reason I'm getting at this is because if you're talking about the transformation of state power in relation to the global economy, and just the transformation of state power itself, a lot of these changes aren't, you know, they're not like they're being, you know, codified and declared formally, you know, like some document you can go and see how it works. But through spaces outside of official state bounds, outside of the realm of law, which are transforming the nature of power itself, which is, I think, sort of where you were ending. You know, going back to, you know, back to Germany, the actual changes in law, which was enabled the death camps, like, it wasn't like they were all put in law. There was just, like, I think, like maybe like two little changes in law, which just changed the nature of police power. And then all of a sudden, this enabled massive transformation of state power without actually being codified as such, you know, because it was all very, you know, it wasn't like they were, you know, there was actually a declaration of, we're going to do this. Okay, so in particular, like these sort of spaces where the rule of law is suspended, for instance, Guantanamo Bay, Abu Ghraib, or particularly included in laws such as Patriot Act 1 or 2, it creates zones not covered by national or international law, where there's a vast expansion of unchecked executive and sovereign power, which are basically created through ideas around states of emergency, or basically, like, these are, you know, it's usually always kind of, these are only temporary powers, but temporary powers, you know, have a way of becoming less than temporary, they keep going. And so it's these zones of these zones of spaces which are somehow outside of law and outside of state power, places where basically anything can occur, not because it's like, you know, officially decided upon, more because it's based upon, you know, like, I guess you say, the goodwill of the captors, which is a really sketchy thing to rely upon. But these spaces outside of law, at the same time, create forms of power and subjugation that are captured within law and transform how law operates itself. And so if we're trying to understand the changing nature of how state power is operating in the global economy, it's really hard to do this if we're continuing to think that the state is one thing, because it's not. I mean, one instance is, I think this happened a few months ago, a bunch of people in Congress had realized that Chapter 11 of NAFTA had given you know, various corporations the power to sue the U.S. and overturn laws, and they said, we didn't know this happened, which was really funny because they signed the damn law. But it's funny because if you're thinking of this, you know, of a state as one thing, things like this wouldn't make any sense, because if government power is one thing, well, why is it doing something that's undermining itself and all these, like, why would it do that? But if you're coming at it from, like, seeing how there are different processes of power which can work in conflicting and contradictory ways, it's a lot easier to see, you know, and explain why these things are happening. And so, just I'll be very short, just to conclude, so we can get on discussion, is if we want to be able to open up spaces of possibility and autonomy, and to also to recognize how processes of domination and control are working, it's really difficult to do this effectively if we're seeing state power in the state as one thing, when in fact it's not really many more smaller pieces and things contradict themselves. Okay.
I think even though we didn't overlap a lot, I think I agree with pretty much everything that I said.
What we're supposed to do is say, insofar as your theory is not my theory, it is critically flawed and you are a very bad person. And it's like, I've been to like so many academic classes where people actually do this constantly, and it's so annoying. So I guess to say, I think you both of you are very right, and I think you're very interesting and cool people. So.
I agree.
Come on, let me see a fight.
Other people have ideas on how they see shifts and what's happening with statecraft, as opposed to also questions or comments, or just, but it'd be nice to have a discussion about what other people think about it too.
A question, not a comment. I guess when you were talking about some of the trajectory you saw for statecraft, I was sitting there thinking like aspects like coming from Canada and more the social democratic state, and it didn't quite ring. Some of it rang very true, and some of it didn't. So I was wondering if you could, I don't think I can really flesh that out very much. I think the comments of how you see that vis-a-vis like the more social democratic northern states. I don't have a good analogy. Just like the expansion of control, the expansion of the police function, I see, but less. Sort of fertile is the whole the function that the state sort of assuming so much of the social realm and so forth. That's sort of like more of the contradiction within the state, and also I guess the preemptive function I don't sort of see as much, or the projection of, and then obviously there is the projection of power abroad and so forth. Comment on that.
I think one thing that I agree with, I think pretty much all of us echoed, was that like not all states are exactly the same. There's not a kind of linear evolutionary model of how states work. In some ways, I see the Bush regime as like a residual from like a really crude, old kind of, like I saw the Clinton administration as more functional for what we call corporate globalization and stuff, which even though it was like warlike, has this kind of facade of peace or something, where the Bush administration is just all out total war, So all states aren't alike, but over fetishize Foucault, but he had like some interesting things to say about how, and this is where I think his anti-statism is partly, is that all states are inherently racist. And this is something I didn't really get to bring into my talk, but even socialist states, the former socialist states, I've always relied on this kind of partly real but mostly imaginary, distinction between an inside and an outside. And always investing in this like creation of a hostile outside. But I don't know if this is answering what your question was, but even the socialist states engaged in disciplinary regimes in terms of it wasn't capitalist discipline, it was socialist discipline, and it was still this kind of vast apparatus that was trying to not negate the energies that people create, publics create, but kind of have an apparatus over them to use those energies, to like channel those energies towards its own ends.
I want to say something. Do you
want to
go ahead? And
I just want to say that I'm not particularly familiar with the government of Canada myself, but I just want to say that oftentimes we assume that power control are things which we see which are like okay, bad things are power control, but power control also operate through things which can, and processes which can seem quite positive. Mm-hmm. For instance, like how healthcare collection of data or trying to monitor, you know, different ways with the monitoring of data and populations, and power processes which we can seem, you know, and are quite positive, but also, you know, are also act ways of monitoring people and controlling them, and perhaps you could see, you know, the way the Canadian government is taken, or for instance, like Scandinavian governments. It's not that that power isn't being exercised; it's being exercised in perhaps, you know, like, you know, let's say state power has on like a glove on, you know. I don't know the particular case in, you know, detail, but that's what I think it'd be more in that sort of direction.
And I just like to say, I think some of these things, like this notion of preemption, it's contested inside the Bush administration. I think there's been struggles about what the sort of vision for the world, why there's sort of arguments oftentimes about whether we're multilateral, the United States, the U.S. government is multilateral or unilateral, or how the state is going to respond in the U.S. because it's a superpower right now, in a sense that fight plays out over the world. So when that doctrine of preemption, which was discussed 10 or 15 years ago, starts being implemented on the streets at events, and then globally in Iraq, and then now Russia in the past few weeks is talking about doing the same thing, that it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen everywhere, but other states learn from each other, and they're also compelled to do things. So the social welfare system, because of the changes in capitalism, is going to have to break down. It already is in Canada. I mean, and it is in Europe, and it is in a lot of the countries that become social democracies. They can't control their national economies anymore in the same way under much more heavily globalized forms of capitalism right now. So they're going to be forced to make changes over time, and it may take a lot longer. And the last thing I want to say is, that's why I point to Guantanamo Bay, and I think a lot of times people have this idea of the United States being the problem, and I was in Europe for about maybe 5 or 6 months last year, and I've never experienced so much the United States is the problem, and people in the and in countries like Germany and France and England, and it was astounding to me, as if the Germans were like, we didn't go into the Iraq War, and I was there during the, you know, 1 year anniversary celebration, they're all Yankees go home, the U.S. is the problem, and here in the German state, not to mention its own historical legacy, which it needs to deal with, but at present day, it's very powerful. It's doing all sorts of things. Like, it is where, you know, when troops get shot and they need to recuperate, they go to that air base in Germany. That's what they're always talking about in the news. Every day, someone's being shipped over there when their leg's blown off or something. So they're not engaging in, all those countries have people in Guantanamo Bay. So even if they're not sitting back and saying, oh, we're not really part of that, we're neutral, we're not engaging, of course they are, and they're being part of the experiment in this in different ways, but it's not going to look the same in different places. I really like the way Stephen was talking about the state not even being the single unified thing that you could point to. It's the same thing every place also. So I think it's sort of, to some degree, to think that these, so all I was trying to point to in my talk is to point to tendencies that potentially are pushing other states to have to respond to and work with each other, and maybe ultimately completely wrong, but I think it's a contest right now going on where different states are pushing each other to do things, as the EU is pushing the United States to do things it doesn't want to do, for instance, too.
Yeah, I have a comment, but you may want to respond. If anyone does, that'd be really good. I think talking about globalization and, or what we can call globalization, and the changing role of the state, a lot of traditional Marxists and people who take a more materialist approach, like say like Emmanuel Wallerstein or something, have really said that actually what we've been calling globalization lately is something that's not new at all. It's been going on, and they've tended to say that, well, nothing's really new. What was really good about this talk, I think, is that you all rooted it in sort of like a sociological analysis, or something that got beyond talking about these more ephemeral changes that have happened. But the only thing is, I was wondering, I know you had to generalize just because of the time constraints, but I still think there's a real need to kind of root, to analyze what's happening, but also root in why it's happening. And again, it depends on your approach, I suppose. But I was wondering if anyone could address some of the very more structural or material changes that some of these things can be rooted in as far as why they're happening, not just what's happening.
I'll just say really briefly, I think Deleuze addresses this in the article on Postscript on Societies and Control, but I think part of the reason why, and I agree with him, that's why I use him, but why these changes are happening are because a lot of these institutions or former enclosures really are in crisis, like tangibly are in crisis, even though that's also kind of like propagated in the media. There is some truth to the fact that like families are in crisis, schools are in crisis, you know, and you know, I mean, a lot of it is because of, you know, and I think someone brought this up also, like this is a lot of the privatization of all these institutions that used to be, you know, now don't even have to present, like pretend to be accountable to a public. So, you know, this is kind of like the system, so to speak, creates its own problems, you know, it could, like kind of undermines it, you know, it shits where it eats, I don't know, like, and undermines, you know, it pollutes the soil of its own existence, kind of. So I think it really is like institutional crises that are prompting this shift to control is because states are having trouble, states are worrying, and, you know, are worrying about, like, controlling people and populations, so.
I would think, it's a very broad question, I would think generally, I would look at different kinds of technological transformation. But when thinking about this, one of the ideas I really like coming out of autonomous is sort of like, how do you put this? Usually in Marxist theorization, you know, capitalists and people who control things do things, and then the work, you know, the workers were responds. But the formulation is that, well, no, actually, it's the self organization of workers that then causes people in control to respond to that. So then one could say, well these shift to these sort of like global networks of capital are because as populations in countries begin to able like to shape their lives more there, you know, we'll just, you know, put this way, as people begin to have influence in the state, they'll say, oh, we'll just gut the state, you know. So I like taking that kind of perspective because then it shows that these transformations are actually happening as it basically, you know, well, you know, people in power is scared and reacting to things that have happened previously, as opposed, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like inverting it.
Yeah, makes sense.
That's why I really point to, I really, really was probably influenced by reading Manuel Cassell's book last year, and I'm so tired, I can't remember the title, but it's a 3-volume set on looking at this is society, economy, and identity. And he makes the argument, for instance, that the new social movements in the 60s were really concerned with questions of identity, which created a whole bunch of social movements. And a lot of that also meant that people experimented in forms of sort of network, cooperative, decentralized forms of living and existing together. And a lot of those people started also tinkering in their garages and basements with forms of technology. And a whole shift emerged in technologies with internet, etc., the digital technologies shifts. And a lot of those people were coming out of that, his argument, were coming out of that, and to some degree that influenced the very organizational structure of the technology too. So it emulated forms of organization and questions of identity that had come out of that. And so for instance, I edit books for a living, so I just edited this wonderful book on control and freedom using Deleuze, trying to argue that we're shifting to a control society, but it was using the internet as an example, which is a very trite example, but it was really well done in this book, about how that allows me to be anything I want. It both allows an incredible freedom where I can go online because I can be any gender, any sex, I could be multiple genders, no one knows where I live, I can create my own, I can become who I want to be again and again and again. So it allows me the ultimate freedom to continue to reshape myself, which is something we want to be able to do. But at the same time, there's this lurking sense of paranoia and control where you're never sure, is everything I'm doing being read? Do they really know who I am or where I am? So freedom and control become so interlocked in that technology and how we use it and how we think about what freedom means also, even removing it from the technology. So that's, to me, one example of how both social movements, in the way Stephen said, of different changes and technological changes and cultural and social changes interact with political changes, and I don't know how to separate that out. Is that
right.
Technology or economics or, you know, our identity? And that tool also becomes a tool of social control and a tool of resistance, that piece of technology, etc. So to me, that's why I really wanted to point out. I was really influenced by this book I just edited, where if freedom and control become so interlinked, how do we really understand what freedom could be without this lurking paranoia sense in the background of, so I have more freedom than I've ever had, but there's some weird sense of something I can't see that I know might someday come in and stop who I think I am being right at this moment. And they're completely bound up right now in that example I just used.
I don't know if I don't have this fully thought through in my head. I'm not sure how articulate this is going to be, but although I agree on a certain level with the comparisons to what's going on in Guantanamo Bay with sort of classical fascism or aspects of it, totalitarianism, I think that socially and economically and organizationally, what the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, the society that they're trying to build, is actually much more in line with classical fascism, and that for all of the changes and all of the really nefarious and evil things that are happening in sort of Western states, I still think I'd rather live under those than under classical fascism. And that raises a real question of like multiple levels of enemy, and how on some level do we negotiate or leapfrog what appears to be our immediate enemy to deal with what's possibly a much more, in the long run, dangerous enemy to have, and not allow, I mean, I just think that it's a really dangerous game to think that the state that we're talking about here is going to successfully grapple with our other enemies. And how to deal with different kinds of state development when we've sort of been removed from the ability to actually contest these other developments. I don't know if that's that articulate.
I actually want to make a quick clarification. I get really concerned about them like free and easy use of the word fascism. So I'm not convinced. I think fascism was a very distinct emergent form in the 20th century, and after 45, I'm not sure, I find it problematic applying that term. So I wasn't arguing that there's some new form of fascism right now. I think there's something else going on. I don't know what term should apply to it, and I'm not sure it's fascism. Maybe, I haven't thought that through well enough, but so I wasn't arguing for some neo-fascism right now. So,
Maybe
Al-Qaeda is a good example of maybe, that maybe emulates more of the, what fascism, what is distinct about fascism, but that's maybe a whole, it would be great if someone did a workshop here on fascism in a sense in relation. But, so that's one thing I wanted to say, I wasn't arguing that, but I think what you're pointing to is, and that's again why, like freedom control, I've been really interested in this topic of freedom control, because I think more and more, you don't need a fascism that's completely brutal and ugly and clear cut, and that it seems more like we live in a much nicer, more, at least for many of us in North America, the appearance of freedom is so much greater, and perhaps it's actually true in a lot of cases, but at the same time I think there's all sorts of multiple forms of nuanced domination that are so deeply invisible and separated from each other and contesting each other too. And I don't know we've had a lot of debates here over the summer on what does intervention look like as an anarchist anymore? Like if you're not just like trying to dismantle the state and capitalism, but also things like Al-Qaeda, and like what would it mean for us, and where would we do those things, and a host of things that aren't even institutional in that way too. It becomes incredibly complex. At the same time, I think a lot of us feel a lot more free in a sense than we've ever felt before, because there's not the really, Nazism was very just, you know, very brute, much more of a clear cut form of, you know, that's the person we don't like with the swastika on them, etc. Although even Nazi Germany is much more complex than that. So I think that was a very complex form of social domination, but it's become even more complex than that. So, yeah. So that's not really an answer, because I think that's a really profound question. It's like, how do we deal with like multiple forms that are more and more hidden?
Yeah, actually, I agree again. In terms of like my piece on control societies, like I'm definitely not equating fascism and control societies. I think they're two very different things. And along the lines of what she just said, like I think that in some ways fascism compared to control societies are inefficient and crude, whereas a control society can maintain, you know, this appearance of freedom and actual, like some really substantial freedoms that are also like producing information at the same time, and, you know, technologies that are, you know, used to monitor and gather information, that, you know, all technologies are ultimately become used for things outside their original intent, right? So, in the same way that, say, colonialism proper in its crude, like, form, in a lot of ways, you know, I mean, this is debatable with Iraq and everything, but, you know, colonialism was supplanted by, like, neocolonialism, which was, you know, characterized by, proxy forces or whatever, and it was more efficient in that way. Like, these kinds of, like, less direct oppressions can be more efficient, less visible, and I think control society is actually something very different than fascism.
I didn't mean to sidetrack the discussion by implying that you guys were calling this fascism. That's not what I was trying to say. But what I was trying to say is that there actually are social forms that are increasingly powerful in the world that actually do look a lot more like fascism than control societies. Like, extremely misogynistic and male-dominated. They're economically non-productive and basically just leech off of black markets or create labor camps. It's violently expansive. I mean, there's all of these kinds of things within, particularly like Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, systems that actually do resemble, in a lot of ways, classical fascism. I guess I was arguing that in some ways, I'd rather deal with the problems of a control society than the problems of that. That's increasingly powerful, and there might become a day when that's actually what we have to deal with, and should we maybe start thinking about dealing with that now? I guess that's...
I see your point. I partly agree with you, and I partly disagree. Like, I think that, when I tried to bring up, like, contemporarily why people are complicit sometimes in their own subjugation, I think, well, part of it is because, well, security is really, there are real threats to our security. It's not, the left would like to kind of ideally say, that these threats are all false or something, but there are actually real threats, and there are people who would like to kill us regardless of whether we're leftists or, fundamentalists of whatever kind, so there is this kind of like, it's a tough question. I'm not sure how much of that, like, I do think that there are, threats that you described that are real, but I'm not sure how dangerous the threat is in terms of actually, like, establishing some kind of fascist state over people. I mean, I think in some ways it's more about just killing people, like obliterating people, which
that's sort of what makes it interesting, is that it's not necessarily interested in a classical state. Like an Al-Qaeda situation, it's this sort of transnational kind of, it's an evolution that's actually more scarier.
I guess that's why I was pointing to, maybe I always like giving talks because you can like throw out ideas you're not sure of and then like hear what people say and then rethink your ideas and present something different the next time. But that's why, in a sense, for me, I started thinking about the state and the nation being separate, because that sort of describes what's happening with how, the state in the classical sense, the United States, whatever, Europe, etc., European states, and things like Al-Qaeda, and that they're both, in a sense, I think both of them are starting to strive for breaking this idea of like national boundaries and moving to supranational levels of larger and larger blocks of control that would actually encircle the globe and have different forms of governance that would be outside of how we traditionally understood states. And they're both trying to do that, and one's trying to do that without the traditional sense of a state, and the other's, I think, trying to do that without this traditional sense of some shared identity, which still, when you go to places like being in Europe last year again, was striking, because you go to certain countries and there's definitely still like the Dutch, or whereas you come to the United States and it, there isn't some culture I can point to like that in the same way. So there's still, that's still more bound up there in, let's say, the Netherlands than it is here. So that becomes separated. And so what makes us have to do is think about not what are we going to do about it, because I don't really think we have the capacity really to stop necessarily one or the other right now, unfortunately. I don't think we have that power, although we should try. But it helps us start thinking about, okay, as anarchists, where are decision making forms happening that might look different than how we've classically understood the state. We might have to come up with a different term for that that would include things like whatever the hell happens with something like Al-Qaeda over time. Because over time, I don't want to say it was just going to turn into a Nazi Germany, but it could turn into a, and it already is, making geopolitical decisions by its actions. September 11th, if Al-Qaeda did that, and I think, you know, let's just say for the sake of argument, it did, the group did, had made, was engaging in governance with that act for some, because it changed certain, it changed decision making to some degree around the world. Certain policies changed after that, or were put into order. So it changed the world politically as much as in other ways too. So I have to grapple that as an anarchist. If I'm concerned about who's making decisions about the world, and that's what I'm concerned about with governance, that to me becomes something to incorporate into an understanding of forms of governance I don't like. And I don't understand, that's why this understanding of the state becomes problematic, I think, for anarchists, because it looks really different than anything we've understood the state to be in the past. Or maybe the anarchist understanding of the state in the past has been wrong, too. We might want to go back and rethink how anarchists have understood the state from the beginning. So,
can I say a question? Oh, actually, I want to ask a question to Spencer. Because I'm okay with the conversation going. I was thinking what you were saying last night about national anarchism and this whole but like weird outgrowth of people like adopting currents coming out of like sort of like the left wing ecological parts of fascism, and then trying to go to the same, wasn't something about like we want like decentralized like ethnically pure communities. Like I think that sort of mirrors what we're talking about of like ways which certain ideas that we find very, very, very sympathetic could actually go in very scary directions. So we can say, if you could add some, you know.
I'm sorry, in what direction?
Not sure exactly. I thought it was interesting here between those two currents and like how that works.
About how ideas can be double-edged, or
something like that.
I don't know. In general, I've always, although I've been in the anarchist scene for a long time, and sometimes I often do comments and stuff that to other people, I've never really liked the term, and I kind of consider myself a libertarian socialist because I don't really agree with the anarchist critique of the state as such. It's interesting how the anti-globalization movement out east got picked up and combined by like ISE people with the emphasis on direct democracy as a form of governments versus state power is very heavy, whereas in other places maybe the ecological emphasis and the fact that the WTO was going to overturn ecological laws became the emphasis of it. And so there's a very different perspective I find in anarchism here in the East about our relationship to state power, but I still am not really sure that we should continue to follow this classical take on the state. This is not, I still can't, I'm not sure what to do in regards to national anarchism. With this, they abandon the state, they abandon the idea of the state. When they say national, they mean national as a nation, and they read that as the bulk, the nation state representing the nations, like, and they read that through the German conception of Volkishness, which is basically because of people and race. So when they say nation, they mean like racial anarchism. I can't. I need more coffee before I can.
I just want to sort of add both what you were saying, but also Josh's. I mean, in a way, that's why I think it's important. I shouldn't have said it. I just realized I shouldn't have said, well, we can't do anything about it. We're powerless. On the one hand, I feel like we really are right now. But what I think we do have the power to do, and this is one reason why I like organizing this conference and having you all come here and start thinking about this, is I hope we can start to do some better work than like Empire about trying to understand Hart Negri's work, about trying to understand what is changing about how decisions are made, in a sense, locally, regionally, you know, continentally, and globally. And it seems there's some profound and big shifts going on. If we don't even understand that, I'm not sure we even know what we're smashing or dismantling. And, you know, I mean, I don't even understand, the smash doesn't make any sense. Smashing social relationships never makes sense anyway. But what we're trying to, what kind of social relationships we're trying to reforge or forge or invent. And so it's really important to understand what those different things are right now. And I don't think any of us are really at all close to doing that. Marxists might be farther ahead at putting out ideas in the world, like through books like Empire, but I think they've got it so wrong in a lot of ways. That's why I hope that we continue to think about what the hell that means and looks like, and not just go, yeah, we're against the state. That just sounds like such hollow rhetoric right now. I think more and more it sounds really hollow for anarchists just to say that.
Well, I mean, that's the funny thing about the idea of the state itself is that people are constantly talking like the saying they're directing their actions towards the state, you know, and actually trying to change the state. But what they're really saying is they want to change relations. Mm-hmm. And the state is a relation, and there's the really great quote by Gustave Flandeau, which says, you know, I forget the specific of, like, the state being a social relationship. So it's almost, by talking about, you know, like, wanting to change the state, it sort of, like, almost blurs what we mean is we want to change how people relate, you know, which is... I think if it's just start saying that, it would actually be much, you know, more accessible to people instead of like talking about, you know, wanting to get away with the state. We're like, no, people, you know, we hope people can relate differently.
I just thought it was really nice that all our panelists here generally are getting in. It seemed like you guys were all like agreement about like looking at power not as some sort of like singular thing and like getting much beyond like what a lot of the classical anarchist stuff is, and hopefully what this conference is trying to facilitate, and looking at like the different ways that power is playing out. But then hopefully if we can take these discussions and try to figure out like where, even if there are, you know, these multiple enclosures in which state power might only do one of them, you know, or, you know, but trying to then figure out where we as people and individuals and activists can fit ourselves in and have some sort of agency.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that that's another step. I'm not sure if I have wonderful suggestions about it.
And that would have been helpful to RNC. I feel really despondent after the RNC 2 weeks in New York around the RNC, because I think we're so confused, myself included, about what it is happening in terms of governance now, what it is we're trying to fight against, much less we'd want to put in. And so what was the message out of that 2 weeks? I just came away completely, despondent about it, you know, the no Bush, not well, that just isn't saying anything, I don't think, in terms of how we would articulate what it is that's happening in terms of governance right now.
I've never really read a lot of like classical anarchist texts, and for the most part, I find them dreadfully boring. and the way I came to radical philosophy was more by working at a gas station and feeling very alienated about things that were going on, and then reading Max Weber and getting the part about like the iron cage of rationality was going to implode and destroy our lives, going, oh fuck, it just sucks. What, you know? It was something where like you come to conclusions not because you like found like the best pocketbook ever, but because you know it just come to and it sort of makes sense, you know, like, oh, we'll just get rid of these processes of domination. Ta-da. Yeah. But yeah, so
given you're talking about that the state and that power is so hard to pin down now, and I think that we're at a time where we're looking around at each other going, well, what could we possibly do that would matter if we can't even, you know, catch a moving target in the dark? And so then there's this idea of, like, don't fight the revolution, live it. And I'm wondering, like, where do you feel like this is a time to focus more on building up a culture underneath this and, like, creating something rather than focusing on dismantling something and like hoping that that will grow so strong that it'll break apart above us? Or like what is any of your take on that?
Actually, that's a really good question, because I think that gets at the heart at like an old kind of debate on the left about, Murray Bookchin had a book called Lifestyle Anarchism or Social Anarchism. And I think I think about that a lot, because I think that binary needs to hopefully be like obliterated, and because, you know, on the one hand you have people who engage in purely social radicalism of whatever stripe, that's all about organization building and very top down and recruitment and trying to build these mass movements that really you know, fail historically. And then you have other people who are just strictly lifestyle and aren't making connections with other people, but, you know, they're, you know, eating all the right foods and, you know, doing this and that, and maybe they don't have a job and they're not, you know, consuming much and stuff. But I really feel personally it's that we have to find ways to, like, you know, force connections between those two, and that, and actually as individuals and collectivities discover what our own capacities are, because I think some people, by virtue of where they are in structures, can't really engage much lifestyle politics, and other people can't really engage much, like, social politics. So, but, you know, that's up to each of us to decide on our own, like, how we can contribute, how we can plug in, and you never know until you try, kind of, like, but I think that in a paradoxical way, like, everything we do does matter. Like, everything, it matters even though you can't see it in a kind of radical materialist sense. So, but yeah, I mean, in general, I just think that the struggle has to be waged on as many levels as possible, by as many people as possible. That's a really generic meaning of that.
There's this weird sort of puritanism in American culture that infects even organizing work, where it's not that, like, where people don't say, like, you know, I'm doing this because this is a good idea, don't have to work this way, but more because this is, like, the right way to do it, and all I was doing things are sort of, like, you know, not what should be happening. And so, like, partly, like, we really, really love to go out and, like, you know, to the woods and build a commune and just live there, but I want to do that in a way that didn't become disconnected from everything else. And so I think what you're asking is, yeah, it's really important to, like, you know, to, like, build sort of, like, alternative structures and communities, but also important that they don't become, like, you know, disconnect from everything else. Right? Is that sort of what you're thinking? Or what should be?
Yeah. I think I was asking it a little bit more in relation, possibly in relation to the fact that the power has become so diffuse and it's really, really hard to figure out where it is. But, I mean, that is definitely the general question that I'm asking, just your take on that dilemma as it can seem, or just, like, fluid situation.
My understanding of what's happening with globalization is that more and more of the world is, in a sense, so much of the world, including life and us, is so deeply commodified, and we're so increasingly damaged by all sorts of systems of domination, but particularly capitalism right now in terms of what's happening, that I don't think you can actually go in the woods, and I think that's a false thing to, I'm going to go in the woods and I'm not engaging in those social relationships anymore. I don't think that's really possible. But that being said, I didn't, someone might be in the room who's an organizer of the Life After Capitalism conference, but I hate that phrase, life after capitalism, which is Michael Albert's, as if you just somehow, there's this moment where, oh, it's all done, we're outside it, now what are we going to just do? The point is, you have to find places now, things we can do in the political, cultural, economic, etc., that point beyond the present in ways that are in the direction of our values. And there are those little moments, and we have to do them. And so I agree, it's like these false dualisms of, is that lifestyle, or is that, you know, the real revolution, or this, to me, are absurd. But what are those places that point beyond capitalism, that point beyond, you know, gender relationships that we don't like, that point beyond politics? This panel was, to me, specifically about, in a sense, or at least for me, is political power, politics, governance, state, how we understand how social decisions are made. And so I just want to, Todd May, who's a post-structuralist anarchist, was here at the Institute for Social Ecology. Someone gave this incredible four-part class on Foucault and anarchism. And he was like, why do political philosophy? And he's like, well, what's at stake in political philosophy is, it's not just a game, a philosophical game. What's at stake is the question of power. And he's a Foucauldian, so his understanding of power is both it can be creative and it can be destructive. But he's like, what's at stake is us understanding how we can struggle to create forms of power that are in line with our values, that are, so we all share the decentralized power to develop who we want to be in terms of our gender, or how we live our lives, or how we make social decision making. And so that's what's at stake, I think, in the question here, is it isn't just about, I'm going to go, I think in every area of my life I should try to have things that point, but in terms of this panel, what are those areas that point beyond how decisions are made, social decisions are made right now? What are those places that could become enough of a power that could ultimately change the social relationships about how decisions are made, in large scale ways? And so maybe Argentina is an example for a year or so that pointed beyond how decisions are made about cities or neighborhoods, etc. Perhaps, maybe not. You know, I encourage people that are around me. I'm going to go to Graciela's talk. She's going to critique a lot of. I'm really excited to hear it, critique a lot of what happened there too, as much as it's positive. But for me, that's what's important in political philosophy. What kind of power? What kind of things we're going to do to point beyond power relationships and decision making that we don't like right now? And I'm supposed to be keeping time, and we're actually about 5 minutes over when this was supposed to end. And if either you want to say anything, wrap up, and if anyone else does, and people.
Brilliant statement. State bad, make go away.
Squish the state.
Squish the state. Yeah.
Squish the state.
Sort of like this.